Off the Ball Daily.
A home for your favourite podcasts from Off the Ball.
You can never put that many personalities on one pole. Like, even when I'm training and Nathan's training, we're sure we're brothers, but like something always happens where you have a disagreement.
Subscribe to the Off the Ball Daily podcast feed right now.
All right, everyone. Welcome, welcome, welcome. How's everyone? Give it up. Now, when I introduce this man in a second, right, just pretend you can't see him, right? Pretend it's this big, huge surprise, right? So I don't know how many people here are familiar with the series You Had to Be There that we've done. But we started it about 3 years ago, and the first two guests we had were football journalists Graham Hunter and Jonathan Wilson. And initially it was a very detailed view of like a player or a sports person, an athlete who played amazingly at a game or event that you were at. And then eventually that evolved into just an overall event or a game. And now what it's become is basically a conversation about life. So it's probably at its best iteration. So for the last year, we've had Paul Mescal do his You Had to Be There with Owen. We've had Danny Dyer, Armando Iannucci, and just before the All-Ireland Hurling Final, we had King Fisher. We were trying to get him to play Killa at Croke Park, and the GAA never did. But we made our best efforts to it. But amazingly, in the 3 years that we've done this, we have never had the man behind me. So I think it's fair to say, with the best players, the best games, and the best stories, there's only one man for it, and that's the former Republic of Ireland manager and all-round legend, Brian Kerr. Welcome, welcome, welcome.
Well, that's not a bad start.
You're a music man as well as a football man.
Yeah, I am, but, you know, it's hard to keep up with it all. I looked at the list and I said, Jesus, I don't know that many of them. But I was able to put a few pink hearts on a few of them and say, oh, I want to see them. But it's hard to keep up with it all. It keeps changing, doesn't it? But it's a great lineup. I've seen three bands. Four bands so far. Good. I'm baffled.
The lasting memory on you, for sure.
Hold on. Oh, no, they were all right. So I'm waiting on the rest of it.
So you're, you know, renowned for being one of the ultimate football and soccer people in the country. But people might not know that Brian Kerr was a fairly dab hand at hurling back in the day, a goal-scoring hurler.
I think a dab hand would be an exaggeration. I played hurling. I played Gaelic football and hurling for my school, St. Michael's in Chicago, which is now a museum, a bit like myself, museum part. It's Richmond Barracks now, the school is. But I played, we played a bit, played in Croke Park, played in the two finals for the school. I actually played an under-17 hurling final, and I got 3 goals. In the hurling final. At the time, you were allowed to kick the ball. I got 3 goals in my left foot. They were all calling me Christy Brown afterwards. But anyway, so I was all right. I wasn't bad. But soccer was my first love. Although I went to a lot of other sports events. I went to a lot of Gaelic hurling, basketball, rugby. I even went to water polo, I remember, in a bit of madness one weekend out in Black Rock to watch a kind of Ireland, England, Wales and Scotland in water polo. But they went to anything at that time, but soccer was my first love. So still have it, but still have a bit for the guy as well. Like, I managed to get a ticket last Sunday at 2:30. I got a call from a mate of mine. A mate of mine has a burger van, right? It's a very original man. The name. His name is Shea, and the burger van is called Shea's Burgers, in case you come across. So Shea rang me at 2:30. He said, have a ticket if you want it. I said, I'll have that. And I lashed over to Croke Park. I was sitting on the couch watching the build up to Donegal and Kerry at 2:30, where I was sitting in Croke Park behind the goal at 3:10. So I did rather well. It's good. My house isn't near Croke Park, but I got a rocket and got there quickly.
Your list is extensive, so we'll get into it straight away. Just one last thing before that is, the fun fact about you is that you were soccer mad growing up, never played a game of soccer for the school.
Well, I'm of an age where there was a ban on soccer and a few other sports, but soccer was the main one. You weren't allowed to play soccer if you played Gaelic, and you could be suspended and so on. And that was a regular thing. There'd be photographs of teams in the paper, soccer teams, and blokes would have their heads down like that so they wouldn't be, not to show the ball patch, just so they wouldn't be identified by the GAA people, or you get suspended. There was people where I lived, there was, I lived in Drimna, and there was three lads played called Cooney, three brothers, and they played for Dublin in the hurling. And they all played for a team called St. Stephen's, a junior soccer team. And I remember seeing a picture in the Herald one night, the junior soccer page. And the three of them were faceless in the picture because they were all playing soccer. And that was it. Anyway, I was in school. We weren't allowed to play soccer, but we did play soccer. But if there was a caretaker called Mr. Coote who would confiscate the ball if he caught us playing. And when he showed up in the yard, we'd let on we were playing Gaelic. And that continued on to my secondary school. The last year I was in secondary, the Leinster Schools soccer tournament started, but I just missed it. I finished me leaving that year. But I ran cross country. I wasn't bad. It'd have been great out here, except for that hill up there. Jeez, it's a hard hill up to the main stage, isn't it? Anyone try it? It's tough going. Well, what would it be like at 10 o'clock tonight? Half 10, we make it for the Fontaines.
It was during this time that you're talking about that your first entry comes from, the 1966 World Cup. And before we get into that, how many people here are actually from Waterford? So big group of here. By a show of shout, how many people here are from Waterford? Because there's a connection here for the 1966 World Cup,
yeah,
so, Argentina quarterfinal.
So I had a brother walking in London. He was managing. How are you? You're welcome in. It's no problem. It's loads of space. Lovely soft seats. Anyway, he was managing a pub called the Gunnersbury Arms in London. He rang me dad the night. The opening match was England and Uruguay. It was a nil-nil draw. And he rang me dad. He said, will you let the young to come over? So I was in the pram at the time. It's now since 66. So they duly put me on a plane within 2 or 3 days to go to London to the World Cup. So I was at loads of matches. There was matches, believe it or not, in the dog track. It was a bit like the old Kilcowan Park. There was a dog track, White City. And there was matches played there. The group was England, France, Mexico. And England, France, Mexico. What's the fourth one? How do I remember that?
I'll find that for you now.
England, obvious, right? So anyway, I was at the quarterfinal with England and Argentina, and it was an infamous match at the time because Argentina were booting them and kicking them and so on. It was a warm, hot, sunny day. But there was another quarterfinal on the same day. It was North Korea versus Portugal. Portugal were a great team. Eusebio and Torres, the centre-forward, Coluna, the centre-midfield player. Brilliant team. Eusebio was the dogs. Yeah, you go, great player. Eusebio, goal scorer, he's from Mozambique, but he played for Portugal. Colonies, all that stuff, you know, colonies. So anyway, the match wasn't great, and there was a row. The captain of Argentina kicked Jeff Horst up in the air, and the referee wasn't too pleased, and he sent him off, and he refused to go off the pitch, and the manager came on the pitch, and it was going on. Meanwhile, there was a scoreboard at the far end of the pitch, right? And it was old style. It wasn't the Ginicky one now, the one that comes automatic and digital. That time, a bloke used to have to go across and change the score. So it's high up at the other end of Wembley Stadium. I'm at the dressing room end, and I'm looking. A bloke walks across, and he's saying, well, he's going to put up, you know, Portugal 1, Korea 0. But he didn't. He went over, and he went, Portugal 0, North Korea 1. Right? Big surprise that. Then a few minutes later, he goes again. Two blokes, white coats on them. Ordinary clothes, but white coats. I could spot their suits underneath. Anyway, over he goes, turns the thing over, 2-3. So the 3-0 up North Korea, right? So it was a bit of a turnaround. England eventually won the match 1-0. Portugal won the match 5-3. Eusebio just got 4. It wasn't bad. Just got forward to qualifying the World Cup. But what I want to say to the Waterford people was the two blokes that were doing the scoreboard. I told this story before one time on the radio, on the real radio, and someone rang in and said one of the blokes was their dad from Waterford. And the two lads had gone to London. They were studying. They were students. There wouldn't be no water for the IT in those days. So it must have been going somewhere posh, like Cork or Dublin or wherever. But anyway, they had gone to London to get summer work, and they went to the Labour office, and your man says, "We have a job for you in the park. You can walk down in Hyde Park, cutting the grass and doing the lawn and cutting the bushes. Or there's a job in Wembley Stadium doing the scoreboard at the World Cup, if you fancy that." So I was actually at that World Cup final as a boy, and it was a great experience, and hence my madness for the game, and you know, my love for going to matches and going to big matches. Yeah. But you know, as a 13-year-old kid from Drimna to be at a World Cup final, it was my claim to fame in Drimna for another 10 years. That's afterwards. I'm still getting away with it.
Fair play. That's unbelievable, that story. That's one of many to come over the next 45 minutes or so, because before we get to Italian 90 and your story behind that, and everyone has a story if you were there at that game, is it's kind of fascinating to me that you wanted to be a footballer, didn't work out, but you were into loads of different sports, but people were constantly picking you as captain of your sides, and you got a lot of belief instilled in you that you could make it as a manager, to the point where at the age of, was it 16, you were managing the under-13s? So you had this in you from a very, very early age, the ability to manage.
Well, I thought I was a handy player, but other people didn't think I was that handy. I used to be, I was captain, all right, but it was in the 13D, in the DDSL. It wasn't in the, you know, upper echelons. I got a trial with Coventry, but they found me guilty and sent me home quickly, right? But we had road leagues in Drimna at that time, and there was under 11 and under 13 and a half. And I was playing, I don't know why it was under 13 and a half, but it meant I was eligible anyway. But I decided we should have an under 11 team from our road. And I gathered up all the best under 11s from where I live. Was, it's now the Crumlin Hospital. A few of us might have been there at the Children's Hospital in Crumlin. I lived on that road, on down the front, you know, the entrance. You had to come up the road. No, you had to come down the nice road and turn left, and then there's a little left into the main A&E. I just lived down the road from there, right? My ma used to take in people. She was nice. I don't know where I came from, but she was nice. She used to take people in that were at the hospital and put them up and give them tea and give them their tea and when their kids. Anyway, so I had an under 11 team. I was under 13, so I was managing under 11 team. And we actually won that tournament, which was all right at the time, you know. But so from there, I was playing under 15. We started another 15 team with Crumb United, and I had an under 13 team. So I was playing under 15 Sunday and managing an under 13 team on Saturday. And like, I would have had a fella a bit older with me, but I was the main one. I used to shout the loudest, so I was kind of the manager. So yeah, I was managing from a young age, and I seemed to have something about organising the teams, and I owned the ball as well, which was handy, and that gave me a bit of a licence to go on and keep. But then I started doing coaching courses as well, which was a bit unheard of.
Yeah, it was. Like, was it ahead of its time to have that approach so young?
Probably. I think I was on one of the first coaching courses that there was. It was a fellow called John Jarman. He used to come in from England. It was a fellow called Dave Bacuzzi. He managed Cork Hibs and Cork Hibernians. Sorry, Cork Hibs were the team. Cork Hibernians, they won the double in 69-70. But there was a man, Billy Young. He died recently. A lovely man, managed Bohemians for years. Billy Young started the course for us, kind of a preparatory course before you went in this other course, and I went on that when I was playing under 16 at the time. So I started going on coaching. Well, there wasn't many coaching courses, but as soon as there was something to go on, I went on it, and it was like, it was a bit of an eye-opener, but it was also awkward and embarrassing when you're with, you know, more mature people than yourself, trying to do your stuff and learn, pick up a bit, you know.
Before we get to the Italian 90 story, I'm looking around to see, did anybody go to Italian 90 here? Anyone? No? So what's your Italian 90 story?
They were all at Electric Picnic. Or no, this one wasn't going down, was it? Italian 90, there was no festivals during that, was there? Everyone was there. Or they were in the Submarine Bar, or they were in some bar. Alfie Hale's bar, maybe. I don't know. But they were Alfie.
So you were there, but you were supposed to be somewhere else?
Well, what happened was, that year, I probably achieved my life's ambition. We won the league with St. Patrick's Athletic. I followed Patson when I was a kid, and I never saw them winning anything. I started going in the early 60s. Never saw them winning, you know, nothing. Leinster Cup, nothing. I was at a couple of cup finals. They lost. But I ended up as the manager in 86. And we hit the bar the next year. First year I was manager. And Pats now wouldn't have been a team high up in the rankings. We wouldn't have had a great budget now. You know, it was about how many spot the balls we sold, decided on the budget for the season. So it wasn't so easy. But I managed to put together a fairly competitive team. We almost won the league, 87-88. We're beating in the... We drew on Dundalk. Come in, it's all right, it's cheap, it's all free. We went to Dundalk to win the last game, to win the league. We drew, and Dundalk won the league. So we got runners-up, qualified for Europe. But then I stitched the team together a bit for another year. And then the next year, 89-90, we went mad, and we won the league. And it was great, and we won in Drogheda. Actually, the interesting thing about that we played UCD on a Sunday, on Easter Sunday, we won 4-0, and we had to go to Drogheda the next day to play the second last game of the league. So I tell fellas now, we played on the Sunday and the Monday. They give out now about having 48 hours or 3 days, but we had 1 day. And I remember telling all the players after the match, you know, you just have to go home, get a good bath. This was before ice baths came into fashion and strength and condition and all that. It was like, Get home and have a good rest, have a bath, get to bed early. I didn't. I went out and I had a few drinks because I knew what was ahead of me the next day. So Jesus, I could win the league the next day. But you need to be the way you always are, which is on edge and be ready. But not in ready in that way that I was going to be nervous.
Yeah.
So I went out. We were playing Hurdles Cross, another dog track at that time. And I had a few drinks in the Leinster. Got home late. Met the players in the morning. We have breakfast on the way on the back road to the airport, and up we went to Drogheda. We won the league. It was just a sensational day. I never thought it would happen that I would be the manager of the team I followed to win the league. So Italia 90 came shortly after that. I went to Italia 90. I was down in a place called Cefalù. Lovely place, lovely beach, lovely little old town. Drinks were grand, drinks were cheap. I didn't give a shite how Ireland did, how Jack Charlton did. Fucking didn't matter a shite to me. It was all about Pats had won the league. Let's celebrate this. We were a month later, but I had a great time. I was at the matches. I didn't go to Sardinia for the first one, the England one, but it was at the Egypt and the Dutch one. I didn't go back up to Genoa then for the next one, which was the Italian. Was it? That was the Italian one, the next one. So I did Egypt and...
Last 16, Romania.
Didn't do that. That wasn't around either. So I did two matches, and I couldn't understand why all the people around me were crying when Ireland got through the group. All the officials of the FAI, I managed to mooch a fancy ticket, like in here, and they were all very emotional. And I'm going, I'm like this every week about St. Pat's. Why is only getting emotional now because you got through the group? It didn't register with me that these people weren't really as passionate about every week as they should be about the game.
Yeah.
But it was good to be there, and I saw lots of my mates in the back of camper vans and so on trying to get to Palermo. They were staying in either Termina or Cefalù. And on the way up, there was lots of trouble and accidents and camper vans breaking down and, you know, all that stuff. Christy Moore and Jock Sagosa Stuttgart, but he's going to Palermo now, and these were my mates, and I'm looking at them, and I was battling onto trains and stuff. It was a great time, but it was a great time for me, but not the Jack Charlton part of it.
Yeah, what was your relationship with Jack Charlton like?
I had none. He came in. I was in the dressing room with Liam Toohey the night Jack came in. He came in before the match. I was actually at breakfast with Jack Charlton. He was going to a match to see John Aldridge and Ray Houghton playing for Oxford in a League Cup match, and he called into the hotel we were staying in Sheffield, and I had been listening to the radio earlier in the morning before breakfast, and I heard the match was off, and he came in at the breakfast, and he was telling sitting at the table, say he's going to match.
Yeah.
And I just threw in, that match isn't on. And he looked at me kind of gruffly and I said, that match is off. And he said, oh, fucking hell, I think I'll stay and watch you. And so that was that. And he hung about a bit and he talked to Liam Toohey, who was a brilliant man, an icon, an iconic figure in Irish football. He managed Ireland, managed Shamrock Rovers, and he was a head salesman for Valley Ice Cream when he was managing Ireland. But a great man, brilliant football man. And he said to me after, I knew by his facial expression, he wasn't happy. I said, how'd it go with your man? Jack had just taken over as manager. Yeah. He said, I don't fancy him. I didn't like the look of him. So he...
And he wouldn't say that mostly about people either.
He would have been very reserved.
Yeah.
Reserved but funny and witty. And then in the dressing room, Jack came in before the match and said, if I don't like what I'm seeing, I'll come in the dressing room at halftime, a few words. And we're going, Jesus, you can't do that in front of Liam Toohey. We'd been at 3 European finals, and done very well with good players, good youth players, and Dennis Irwin playing and Pat Kelch and John Sheridan and fellas like that. They were going to do well for Jack after.
Yeah.
But he came in at half time. We're losing 1-0 to England. I started having a go, telling us to boot the ball up the pitch and chase it. And like we had a team, they were all that size. Like Liam used to pick fellas, the smaller they were, the better they were, as far as apart from the two centre halves. He didn't mind as long as they had the ability on the ball and could keep the ball. Like this stuff for Arteta. Like Toohey was at that in 1984 with the youth international team. And so that was the end of it. But that was, so I'd know that Jack asked us to stay on. Liam resigned. Jack asked myself and Noel O'Reilly to stay on. And we said no. We stayed on for one match in Cork, an under 17 friendly. We won 3-0 against Northern Ireland. Steve Staunton played in that, Pat Fenlon played in it. A few other fellas did all right. Big fella Kevin Nugent, centre half. Was Staunton's first international, and but that was it. We got out then. We said, yeah, good luck, you can have it. Now they did made another go and they offered us the under 21 gig, but we said no, we wouldn't stay. It wasn't right. It's just mad
that you knew that early, half time in the first game he came in, that you thought this isn't going to work out. If he thinks we should play this way and we want to play that way, straight away, that's all he needed was that 15 minutes or whatever it was.
Well, it wasn't going to work out with Liam. Liam too, he was such, what he used to say to players, it wasn't very detailed before the match, but he used to say things like, just give it to a green short. And get on from there. And it was like, there was nothing about playing long ball or we to build up 20 passes. Give it to a green short and get on with it. And he'd say to the wide fellas, take your man on and get your cross in. It was very simple and basic, but it was effective and wonderful. And we had 4 years in a row, we got to the European finals. It was only starting up, that stuff. Like, we were beating Iceland and Northern Ireland. We were up in Iceland twice before anyone was. I think before the Icelandic people were in Iceland, we were up there playing against Iceland.
We should stay with the Irish setup and what you did yourself with the underage signs. 1997, you and I were talking on the phone yesterday, and you played Argentina right at the end of that tournament. You eventually came third. He began in the third place playoff, isn't it? But Argentina, I don't know if people know who was in that team, but you had Juan Román Riquelme, Esteban Cambiaso, Pablo Aimar, and the manager who just won the World Cup for them recently, Lionel Scaloni. And he only lost 1-0. It was a mad tight game.
Yeah, but the whole tournament was... I was only in the job from... I think I started in February with the FAI, and I inherited this team that qualified for the World Cup, but they finished third in the European finals in a group, but they got ahead of Italy on goal difference because Italy had four fellas put off in the match and they were beating 6 or 7-0, and our gang drew to... Anyway, so, but there was also different rules for the World Cup under 20. UEFA were working off the 1st of August, like the old school year, for qualification, whereas FIFA worked off January, so there was another 8 months of blokes who were eligible. So I had to try and find who was eligible and not eligible. And get, anyway, I'd no build-up time. We went and played one friendly in May, on May Day in Belgium, and we got beaten 2-1 in Belgium. And that was about it. Then we had a week in Limerick before we went to... We're going to Malaysia for the World Cup. So we knew it was going to be about 40 degrees, and the humidity would be about 1,000%. So what do? We went to Limerick to acclimatise, right? So we trained very well in plastic bags, raincoats, full tracksuits. And it was a lot of sunny days, as it happened. The people walking around the campus in Limerick were looking at going, what the fuck is going on there with that lot? But it was quite effective. Anyway, we went to Malaysia. We lost the first game to Ghana. They were the African champions, 2-1. Then we beat America, 2-1. And then we drew with China, so we were through. And then we knocked out Morocco in the last 16. Duffer got a golden goal. It was the first ever golden goal in World Cup football. Magnificent goal. RTE used to use it now and again. Or they used to use it regularly. Duffer doing a few tricks, going by a bloke, stuck it between the fella's legs, and then he just passed it by the keeper. He was young. Damien was 17. He was 3 years younger than the rest of the group. So we won that one, beat Morocco 2-1. And then we had a handy one in the quarterfinal, Spain. We beat Spain 1-0, Peno, Trevor Malloy. And then semi-final with Argentina. And the other semi-final was Uruguay and Brazil. Brazil beat Belgium 10-0. But anyway, we lost, yeah, to Argentina narrowly. We had a few chances. Colin Hawkins, a great chance near the end of the game, headed her over the bar. We were well in the match, like, there was... You know, 30,000 at that match in Malaysia, Kuala Lumpur. And we just got done. But the good news was we had the third place playoff. Yeah. And we're back with our mates from Ghana. And a lot of our lads swapped gear with them after the group finished. And they're wearing Irish gear when they come back in the hotel. All their lads, the Ghanaian fellas. So it was great. And we beat them 2-1 in the third place playoff, which was played before the other final. Duffer scored again.
But the next year, 1998... Your accomplishments were such that you made Reading in the Years. I was watching it back yesterday. Reading in the Years, 98. So that's when you win the double in Europe with the under-16s and then the under-18s. That's Ireland's first major trophy, first time around. And I don't think anyone had retained it like that at underage group the way that Ireland did. So that's the likes. You're talking John O'Shea, Robbie Keane, Richard Dunne.
Jim Goodwin. Jim Goodwin and John O'Shea, we played for... They were Waterford. That was the club. Oh, Ferrybank? Yeah, both of them. Both of them are at Ferrybank. Tramore. Who was at Tramore? Jim Goodwin. And John was at... Yeah. So we had... They were the under... They were actually 17 at that time. It was called the under-16 European Championships. But by the time we played the final, those lads were 17. But, you know, it was a good team. Andy Reid did great after. John Thompson played a lot. Notts Forest... Keith Foy played a lot with Notts Forest, Graham Barrett, Arsenal, Fal Cork, agent now. His young fella got a game for Rovers last night, actually. Joe Morphy, the goalkeeper, is still playing for Tranmere, still getting the game for Tranmere. So what they were 1981 Berties. Joe was still playing. But it was a good team. The other team was the team with Richard Dunne.
Yeah.
Duffer was eligible, but he was injured for the final.
Gary Doherty was in the...
Gary Doherty.
Teams.
Yeah, Gary Doherty, Liam George, Barry Quinn was the captain, midfield player. There was no Waterford lad on that team, but it was exceptional team. Richie Partridge on the wing, Jerry Crossley, a little Belfast fella, Thomas Heardy, Richard and Jason Gavin were the centre-backs. Keith Doyle was the left-back. The goalkeeper was Alex O'Reilly. We beat Portugal, Spain and Italy in a row in the other one. So we had a handy route to win on that
I was looking at that Italy team. Sam Dalabana, who went on to play for Chelsea, was their captain. And Massimo Donati was another of their...
Of the Italian team.
Yeah. But so, do you know, with Duff and Robbie and Richard Dunne and Andy Reid, like, I presume it was... Like, was it obvious enough that they had the talents to make it? Because I was asking yesterday on the phone, it was like, out of all that 16 and 18 group, but even the year before, 97, who did you think was a shoo-in to make it professionally and have a really, really good long career, who actually didn't?
Well, the talk about the ones that made it. I mean, when I saw Damien, the first time I saw him was the match in Daily Mail playing Ireland against Poland in a three-team group. And I ended up being the manager right after. I didn't realise when I was at the match, I was managing Pats. Some pass, and I just went out of interest. It was a Wednesday afternoon. There was no one at the match, about 300 or 400. And Damien was playing outside left. And he was on the far side in the first half. And I'm looking at him going, I'd seen his name, read his name in the paper, but he was just sensational. He was a year younger than that age group as well. The second half, he was even better. The match was a draw. And it ended up in the toss of a coin, Poland, Denmark, Ireland. It ended up that we Ireland got through, and by the time the finals were played, I was the manager. So I inherited Damien Duff and Robbie Keane.
Yeah.
And I had no doubts about them. But the captain of the team that won in Scotland, we beat Italy in the final, was a lad called Sean Bourne.
Was he West Ham, was he?
He was at West Ham, and he was the only non-Irish born fella in the team. The rest of them were all, they'd been there the previous year. And I went, someone tipped me off about him, a lad in Dublin, Brian Brophy, was a scout for West Ham, and he said, he's eligible, you should have a look at Sean Bourne. So I did, I went and looked at him, I said, he's good enough for us. I got him in, I brought him in, I had him at the training, and he was rougher than the rest of them, tougher. And he had a bit about him, he had a bit of a swagger. I said, this fella's going to be the captain.
Yeah.
And I made him captain, and it was a while after I realised John O'Shea and Jim Goodwin, and you know, the rest of them must have been looking at him going, what was he doing making your man the captain? He's only in, and he's English accent, and he's a blow in. And but I didn't give a shite to me. He was the best player, the strongest player, and he was a great captain. He's still a great fella. But he just had a presence about him.
Yeah.
And he dominated the midfield and all that. But he stayed around at West Ham too long. I think he got soft. West Ham liked him so much. And Harry Redknapp would have been, I think, even the manager.
This wasn't the Frank Lampard press conference, was it? Do you remember he was compared to a guy and Harry was like, oh, Frank will make it right to the top.
And this guy, well, I don't know. Last time I saw him in England, West Ham had loaned him to who was it? I went to see the match. It was Markham against... Jesus, who was it? But the other team, Swansea, they almost got relegated that year. They finished toward bottom in Division 4. And he was playing. Brian Murphy was playing. Goalkeeper Brian from Waterford was playing. And I look at that Sean going, he's better than that. He's better. But West Ham kept him until he was about 22. And he went nowhere. He ended up playing with Barnet. And his dad had a building company, and he was playing part-time for Barnet, and that's what he did. He works for his dad, he's a lovely fella, and he comes over regular. But he would have been the one with the bet, you know, that I was surprised and disappointed. But the rest of them, most of the rest of them did well. Some of them are physios, some of them are good careers, like John O'Shea, you know, Jim Goodwin managing Dundee United, Andy Reid's working at Notts Forest, John Thompson's a physio at Notts Forest, Kevin Grogan's coach in America. The majority of them did all right in the game or outside the game. Well, the way it went, there was an interview process. I had to go for an interview, I remember. I was reluctant to apply for the job because I didn't think I'd get it. And I was never one for applying for jobs. I don't think I ever applied for a job in my life. I think any job I ever got in football, people asked me. And even in life, I had a decent job, and I was asked to do it. I had a job in the college in UCD. But anyway, I knew I had to apply for that, and I did. But part of the process was Brian Hamilton, the ex-Northern Ireland international and manager, managed Everton and Norwich and so on. He was shortlisting from whatever the list was. I had to go and meet him. And one of the things he asked was, what are you going to do about trying to get Roy back? This was obviously his brief from the FAI was, how are you going to get Roy Keane back? And I told him what I was going to do.
Go on.
Just say, are you going to come back and fucking play for us or what? Well, no, I didn't do it like that. Roy said, I said, I will see Roy and talk to him, because I had nothing to do with Saipan, was nothing to do with me. I wasn't involved in any shape or form, and I knew that, you know, in his, it wasn't nice for him, it wasn't nice for anyone, but it wasn't nice for his family, it wasn't nice for his friends in Cork, and you know, he's obviously a passionate Irish person, and it wasn't right that he wasn't playing. It wasn't right that he didn't play in Japan and Korea. But it wasn't right that he wasn't playing.
Yeah.
So that was my approach. So that's what I told your man anyway. And he said, that's fine. He said, you're going to be on the shortlist anyway. He actually said, I'm a bit embarrassed about going through this process with you because you deserve to be on the list based on your, you know, on what you've done in the game.
John Delaney said this to you?
Not Jesus. John Delaney would have had me out the window if he could. If the window was open, he'd have fucked me out. Sorry, I didn't say that. I'm quoting someone else. No, he wouldn't have had me. He'd have had me last on the list. He'd have given the job to Brian Robson, I'd say, or John Aldridge, or it was a French fella, Trousseau, Is that right? Yeah. What is it? Maybe Kevin Morden, good bloke. I don't know. But he certainly, I think he would have went for the next Man United.
Yeah.
You know, and that might work to get Roy back and that sort of stupid stuff. But no, he wouldn't have. I'd say if there was a vote, I think there was five of them on the committee, I'd say the vote was 4-1.
Right.
For me, not against me. But I know who the one was.
From day one, you never got along?
No, he one night I met him at a dinner. I was in good form. We were after winning a few things. And I was in great form. And he approached me and he said, you know, my dad got you that job. And he didn't say it like that. You have to give it to me in water for days. He probably said it like, I don't know. He said, my father was involved in getting you the job. I said, I don't know who you are. But your dad wasn't involved. I got myself the job because I was the best person, which I was at the time. We were winning with Pats, and I was the best person. And he said, "No." I said, "Who's your dad anyway?" Now, I knew who he was. He said, "Joe." And I said something like, "Oh, tickets, Joe," which was going back to Italia 90 and 94 and so on. There was something about tickets being sold loosely, let's say, and money and so on.
Right.
So I was a bit disparaging from the start, so that probably didn't help me, you know. But I wasn't having it. I wasn't having someone telling me that their dad was influential.
Yeah.
So that wasn't a great start. It wasn't the cleverest move, maybe, on my part as the years go on, but at least, you know.
Well, I'd say, like, yourself and Roy Keane would be similar in that sense, that you'd stand up for what you believe is right, don't care so much about authority if it happens to not align with whatever you think. And was the relationship good from the start with you and Roy? Because I imagine, Brian, when you sit down with him, he's like, I don't want to play for Ireland again. But maybe he didn't want to play for Mick again. I'm fascinated to know how that came about.
Well, I wouldn't try to compare myself to Roy in any way. He's, you know, certainly in the top five greatest players ever played for Ireland. His achievements as a player are extraordinary, what he did at club level. And going from Cove to Notts Forest, and going straight into the first team under Brian Clough, and then what he did at Manchester United, and how he carried Ireland, and what he did in the Dutch match. He was an extraordinary player. So I wouldn't compare, and how he's, you know, lived his life henceforth. Remember, the first time I went to talk to him, like, he talked to me about getting left out of the under 15 international, and he said he was one of the only ones didn't get a game, and he was asked to carry the tracksuits into the dressing room, and he wasn't, and you know, his parents were watching and people were crying, and I'm going, look at Roy, I was on a flight, which I was that morning, Dublin to Manchester, and there was a gang of lads from Kerry who were going to Leeds, but they weren't let on the flight by Roy Ryanair for some reason about their identification, so they ended up on this flight with me to Manchester. And I said, Roy, I knew every one of those kids' names. They're only 16, but they've been in the system. And I knew, I was able to talk to them all. I said, so there's nothing. Everyone who is good enough gets his go with us now. I said, that's all finished. So I kind of started from there. And then I'd read one of his biographies the night before, and there was a bit in it about him boxing, but never getting to fight, because I think you had to be 13 before they let you actually get into the ring. And he was talking about training.
Yeah.
And then he started, he was playing football. So, and I understood that because my dad was a boxing coach. And I understood about what it was like, all the training you have to go through before they allow you to get into the ring. So we probably got somewhere on that. But it was, you know, we had a good hour chat. It was probably, I think, about 4 hours. And it was the most fascinating conversation I ever had with anyone ever in my life for that long. It was interesting. And I got there in the end. We agreed, and he was coming back. We'd gone to Scotland for my first match.
Yeah.
And I got a call from Alex Ferguson the next morning. I don't know what he said, but it wasn't very nice. And I'm going, look, he only needs to play a few matches. And he said, his hip is fucking... And I'm going, yeah, I know his hip isn't great. He needs fucking rest. And I'm going, yeah, but I only need him for about 6 matches a year. Now you were saying it was 33 matches in what, 30 months, I think, or 33 matches. Anyway, so that was Alex. So then Roy rang me about half an hour later, and he gave me somewhat similar spiel, not abusing me, but just telling me that his hip was sore and he needed to be careful and so on, so on that. So that kind of floundered. Then Tommy Gorman, Lord rest him, jumped out from behind the PSNI van in Belfast. I'm on the pitch, big coaching session in Glasgow, in Hampden Park, a really important session the night before my first match as manager. And I'm trying to do a bit of tactical stuff, and my mate Johnny Fallon has me phone, and he's going like this, and so I have to go to Chris Hewton. You take the session, go over, and I had a lad, Fintan Drury, used to do a bit for me, and Fintan says, Tommy Gorman's out, been on the news to say Roy is not coming back. He's retired completely international football, and that's the end of it. And I went, all right, great. Let's get on with the session. And then I had to go into the dressing room, explain it to the players, and back to the hotel. And there's, I don't know, you were there, Jared. There was about 100 journalists waiting for me in the hotel when I got back. And I stood against the wall and did a stand-up press conference explaining what had gone on, and that was the end of it. But in my head, I'm going, there'll be another day on this, and I'll get another day on it. And I did.
Jar is either directly or indirectly involved in one of your entries, which I think is probably going to be our last by this stage. It's the Champions League final a couple of years ago. Not so much for the match, but because of the transport to the match.
Yeah, so I'm going to... I was having a sticky time at the time, a little bit of illness at the time. But anyway, I go to Istanbul for Man City for Champions League final, Man City against Inter. So I'm there, I get there the match Saturday, I'm there on Thursday, I'm like an outlier, sussing the scene. So Jer and a few of his mates arrive, like, you know, it's Champions League final, arrive ticketless, as you do for the Champions League final. Like, he doesn't bother asking anyone for a bloody ticket before you go. So I have a bit to do on that one. Actually, funny enough, I ended up walking up to the Besiktas Stadium to meet a bloke to get two tickets off him the day before the match. And I sent that photograph of me standing outside the Besiktas Stadium last night to all my Pats mates, because Pats play Besiktas next week. Anyway, so the lads arrive and there's a bit of a scramble and we're having a good day. And the Saturday, we're going to the match. There's about nine of us and we agreed we'd get a nine-seater taxi. And the lads have paid this lad to bring us out to the ground. But unfortunately, the stadium in Istanbul wasn't in Istanbul. It was like past Athlon, right? Now, not this Athlon, Athlon in Istanbul. So we're in the bus going out, and it's just along. There's a bit of traffic, like coming in here today, like you in the traffic. It's not great. So we're in the traffic for a long time. And we had left like 3 hours to get to the match. But we've only now, we're down to about an hour and a half and we're still in the traffic. But we can see the stadium and looks gorgeous. And we can see it and it's just over there a bit. So some of the bright idea, we get out of the taxi we're stuck in and we walk to the stadium. So out we get and we walk up the road and there's a few blokes there. How are you? What's the story? What's the handiest way? He said, down through here, down through the estate, down, cross, round, up you go. I said, right, we'll have a go at that. So off we went. We went through this. There was new apartments and there was playgrounds. It was a very normal looking place. But then we went down a bit further and it leveled out onto a grass area and there was a road and then we crossed the grass area and then we arrived at what was an open sewer actually running along, right? And our, like, where we wanted to go was just up there, up the hill. But unfortunately, it was at the top of Crowpatrick, right? So the first obstacle was you had to get across the sewer, right? And then there was a 10-foot drop. There was a wall and there was a 10-foot drop. And then there was a pipe, like the pipe that's carrying the water from Dublin to the rest of Dublin, from Kildare. They're blocking the pipe this week, actually. I'd say it was that big pipe, right? And then at the other side was Crowpatrick. Now, Jer, I think, and two or three lads, I decided I got across the first bit, the sewer, which was, it was only like the water jump at the Grand National. I made it over that, right? But then I got to the wall and I said, fucking no. There's no one there to catch you. There was no cushions to land on. There was nothing. So I said no. But a few years, they went for it, right? They were last seen scrambling up Crowpatrick to get to the top. But there was other lads with Manchester City gear on them also doing it. But they were falling down. Some of them were slipping. You know, you see them, see those games where things come back down that are supposed to go. They're slipping back down. So we decided we'd go to do the sensible route and go back out to the road. So off we go, back across the sewer, back out onto the road. And there's a bloke dropping a couple of people off with Manchester City in a Fiat Uno, I think it was. It was a small car. There's now, we're down to, our group is down to six. So, any chance of a lift? Your man says, yeah, okay. So we all piled in into your man's. We're like that. And your man gets us back up to the top of the road where we got out of the taxi, and we're now back up, and we're now down to about an hour to go, and away we went walking, and we're walking along the road, and the motorbikes are driving by us, and if you miss your step, you're down the gully. You could end up in eastern Turkey maybe, or southern Turkey if you go down. So we're with great trepidation, and the traffic is going by us, and there's fans. And there wasn't a sign anywhere. And we got into the game. We eventually, about 20 minutes before the match, I think we walked about 7 or 8 kilometres. The lads survived, I think, with great difficulty. Manchester City played all right in the match. Inter were great. But it's not always cosy, you know, going to matches. Sometimes people think, it's a doddle. But that one was a particularly messy experience.
We haven't even got time to talk about your father fighting Mussolini's son-in-law and not having a chance against it.
Yeah.
We have to wrap right now. We're out of time.
Okay.
That was Brian Kerr's You Had to Be There, everybody.
Thank you.